And now I'm joined on the line by Sandra Losty. Good morning to you, Sandra.
Good morning, Debbie. How are you?
I'm not too bad. Hope you're okay today.
I am indeed. Yeah, all good.
Brilliant. Now, Sandra, you're going to tell us a little bit about your life and a little bit of the walk you're going to do from Howth to Dunleary. So we'll start off by tell us a little bit how it all started and a bit about your life.
Yeah, great stuff. So on the 20th of March, I've decided to walk from Howth to Dunleary because it's, according to Google Maps, that is, it's 25.3 kilometres from one pier to the next pier. So I kind of thought that's a very relevant number for me because on the 20th of March back in 1995 was the very last day that I picked up an alcoholic drink because the next day I woke up in an awful state. Life just, it just wasn't worth living the way I was living at that time, you know. And I haven't had a drink since. So,
well done. 25 years nearly, very good.
25 years, yeah. And it kind of fit with the 25 kilometres. And I thought, I can do that. I went to any lengths to go and get a drink. I went out in snow and ice and rain and storms and all sorts of conditions. I can take a walk along the coastline of Dublin and it's a kilometre per year.
Brilliant. And that'll be a big achievement for you. And great. And tell us, Sandra, tell us a little bit, how did you get to the point of realising, that's it, I can't do this anymore? I suppose if you continue down the way you were, you might not be talking to us today. How did that all start? How did you go down the road of becoming an alcoholic?
Well, I suppose with the hindsight that I have now, at the time it was a huge coping mechanism. So there was quite a lot of upset in our home growing up, and I suppose it became normal, you know, it became normal to deal with things in a very unproductive, unhelpful way, you know. I carried those coping skills all the way through into adult life, but you don't know that that's what you're doing, you know. You're just doing what you can to get by, because there was a lot of disruption due to some alcoholism in the family. Not a huge amount at that time, but primarily my father was a paranoid schizophrenic, and that brought a lot of to-ing and fro-ing to hospitals and all sorts of, you know, scenarios going on in his head that as a child you're going, who is he talking to, or what is he listening to? You know, you don't understand as a child. Even as an adult, we didn't really understand what was going on from, you know, back then. So he would have been in and out a lot of mental institutions to try and help him stabilise the condition and, I suppose, you know, help him to integrate back when he came back out of hospital. But, Debbie, unfortunately, I don't know whether it was the time, I don't know whether it was the treatment, I don't know what the detail of it was, but it got to a point with him on a particular day in March, and his anniversary is the 2nd of March, where he had only been out of hospital a couple of days, and or maybe a week, actually, that's probably more to the point, about a week. And when he would come out of hospital, my mother would go in because she couldn't cope with him. She couldn't cope with, you know, the way that he had to live and all of that went with that. And it's, you know, I mean, God love him. I mean, his mind was tormented, but it brought a certain amount of disruption that became very difficult for people around him. Mm. Yeah, you know. So on this particular day, whatever happened, he had not been long out of hospital, as I said. He obviously was having some sort of a delusion or some sort of psychosis. I don't really know kind of what it was, but something happened in his mind anyway. And my brother and my sister were in the house at the time. He was 14 and my sister was 17. Mm. Whatever the delusion was, it commanded him to attack them whatever reason. My brother survived his injuries, but unfortunately my sister had such severe injuries that the operation they performed on her when they eventually got her out of the house, it wasn't a successful operation at all. She would have been left on a life support machine for the rest of her life.
Oh, God, you know? Love. You got that. Oh, God, that's horrific.
Yeah.
And what age were you at this stage, Sandra, when this happened?
I was 10. I was 10 at the time and in school. And one of the local priests came up to kind of take me back to my neighbour's house where, you know, that was the safest place for me at the time.
Because, Sandra, before you go any further, how come you were in school and your brother and sister weren't? Like, how come you avoided it?
I was in the school, the local primary school.
They were in secondary.
Up in, you know, the convent.
Yeah.
And my brother was in the tech and they, you know, they got to come home for lunch.
Jesus God.
So, you know, like as a 10-year-old and your brother is a teenager and it's real grown up that your brother comes home for lunch and you don't, and then my sister, she had been working at one point in a sewing factory for a few months. I think she was just out of work. I think that's, you know, that was the story there. She had left school and she was out of work and she was in the house at the time. And because that day, after all of that happened, my father then went up to the bathroom and he took his own life. He caused himself injuries that eventually made him lose his life. So he died later on that evening from, you know, severe loss of blood and that kind of thing. So within 2 days, my mother had lost her husband. She'd lost her daughter. We'd lost a father and a sister. And however disruptive life was at that time, you know, it was only preempting what was about to happen, you know, because we all, in our own way, tried to deal with that in so many different ways. Mm. And my way was, when I picked up an alcoholic drink, I thought I was the most grown-up person on the planet and, you know, I was invincible. That's exactly how I felt.
Well, I'm not surprised, Sandra, you did turn to alcohol. I mean, that's horrific, you know, to be told that at 10 years old, your sister, and to be, you were in school, and you were lucky you were in school because if you were at home, you mightn't be alive to tell the story, but that's horrific. Your mother was in hospital, I presume, at that time.
She was in hospital at the time.
God love her, Jesus, God.
Yeah. Her blood pressure would go through the roof, you know, and she couldn't cope, and her blood pressure would go dangerously high, and they had to take her in and manage that. So there was a constant alternating of, she'd be out and then he'd come out and she'd go back in and then he'd go back in and then she'd come out, you know, so
there
was a constant, you know, dipping in and out all the time.
Jesus. And how is your brother today?
It's fine, strangely enough. We don't have a relationship today, not because of that. I mean, there's lots of reasons, but I mean, he's alive and you know, he's living his life and that sort of stuff, so he's grand, I suppose, as much as I know.
So, Sandra, come back then to that, you're 10 years old. What happened in your life then? Did you and your mum and brother, you had to carry on living and get back to some sort of normality?
Yeah. So, mum stayed at a hospital, from what I can remember, and she wasn't even allowed to go to the funeral. Like, they allowed her out of hospital, okay, but she wasn't actually allowed to attend the funeral. So she didn't even attend her own family's funeral stuff. I can only imagine what that did to her, like, as a, you know, your child.
Her
and your
child,
husband.
Yeah. Jesus.
Yeah, and so we tried. The neighbours were amazing. Like, I only thought about this the other day when the anniversaries came up. The neighbours were phenomenal. Like, I mean, they fed us. They brought in pots of soup. They brought in cakes. They, you know, they made sure that things, those practical things, kept ticking over. Mm. I remember coming down one day and there was somebody washing Delph. You know, that sort of way it was.
Yeah.
People just rode in. They just absolutely rode in. And what I was really heartfelt to remember the other day was how they just remembered the man. Like, they understood he was unwell, you know?
Yeah.
And that he wasn't this evil person, because it was depicted in the newspapers. He was vilified in the newspapers, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
And back then, it would have been quite an uncommon story, you know, that would have hit the news, you know,
exactly,
because it was so, like, it would have been so shocking, you know. We're probably a bit more immune to hearing that news now. You know, we hear a lot more of it, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But the neighbours were just amazing, as I said. You'd come down, somebody would be washing Delph, for, you know, somebody would be, you know, getting a bowl of cereal ready for you or something like that, you know. And I think, you know, what happened then was, Debbie, like, It wasn't actually talked about. There was no discussion. There was no detail. I wasn't actually told the detail of what happened. It was always referred to as the tragedy, you know?
Yeah.
And yes, it was a tragedy, but there was no healing from it. There was no working through it. There was no you know, like nobody had the skills to do that. Nobody had the understanding of the impact that it would have, you know. So as a child, I suppose, what happened with me was when I was leaving for school that day, my dad had been eating toast, and I don't like butter, you know, and I was a very expressive child, you know. If I didn't like something,
you didn't like it.
You know, everybody knew about it, you know. So as he bent down to give me a kiss goodbye, you know, going to school, I could kind of taste the butter, you know. I was like, oh, that's disgusting.
Yeah.
And I wiped the kiss away, and off I went to school, as you do on your merry way. And when I heard the news, I immediately thought, that's because I wiped this kiss away.
Aye, you felt, yeah.
And internalised that.
It's mad, isn't it? Jesus.
It's only in recent years I've realised just how much I actually internalised that, in terms of that I actually thought it was because I had wiped that kiss away that he had died and my sister had died because of that.
So you held that for years, thinking it was your fault.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then, so what age did you turn to start drinking alcohol then?
Oh, it was very, very early. Shortly after that, there was an aunt of ours lived in Australia. She still lives in Australia, and she came over, and there was a party in the house, and a New Year's Eve type kind of thing. And I went around pouring all bits of drink into a glass, and that was my first kind of taste of alcohol, but more my first. The effects of it, that feeling of being 10 foot tall and invincible and, you know, you can't touch me kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, that was the first time I got that feeling. And I liked it so much that I would dip in and out when that party was over, and I was very sick that night, and I had a blackout, and the room spun and all that sort of stuff. But that feeling of you can't touch me stayed with me, you know. So it was every opportunity I could get. If there was anything in the house, I'd be nipping at it, you know. By the time I was 12, I was drinking in pubs. You know, we used to go roller skating on a Sunday. I know.
Jeez.
We used to go roller skating on a Sunday, and we'd go into a pub across the way from the roller rink, and we were getting served in pubs at 12.
Oh my God. So this was your, as you said, this was your coping mechanism, having alcohol and trying to forget it. So you bring this up to 12. So how did your life then develop? Did you get a job? How was your mum? Like, how long did your mum live for after that tragedy? Because that must have really affected her.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, absolutely. And she became very, I suppose, disconnected, which is understandable, like, you know, to hold all of that and to manage all of that. She probably turned to the drink. If I'm being honest, there was a lot more alcohol in the house after my father died than there was before. So, you know, I imagine she turned to alcohol in an effort to cope. I shared a bed with my mother, so that was a bit of a rearrangement in the house where, you know, I then shared the front room with my mum, and my brother slept in the back room. So I went to school, you know, kind of hungover most of the time, kind of after the weekend, because we would have been out. There wasn't a whole lot of, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of talk to me. I don't ever remember anybody going, what are you doing, like, coming in smelling the booze or whatever.
Yeah.
It was, we were all dealing in our own way. And if she knew, she never challenged me on it, you know.
Yeah.
But when I was 16, she died in her sleep.
Oh, no. Oh,
and and I woke up and found her dead, woke up late for going to work, because I got a job at that point. I'd left school at 15 and got a job in a sewing factory, and, you know, there was Rosie, you know, as we call her Rosie to drive her mad, you know.
Yeah.
And she had died in her sleep. She had a heart attack in her sleep. The mad thing about this is I had a bit of a row with her the night before over making the bed.
Oh, for God's sake. Oh, God, love you. God, you've had it hard,
you know?
Sandra. Jesus. My God.
It is. But you know what, Debbie? Somehow you got to find the moments in it.
I know. But God, for a 15-year-old to have experienced all that, Jesus. You know, that's a lot.
Yeah.
And as you said, even that little argument, which is probably nothing the night before, you probably held that as well. And that probably was more guilt adding to you.
Yeah.
Which is horrific for a 15-year-old. God, it's hard enough going through puberty and then to have to deal with all this.
Yeah.
So how did you cope then with this?
Oh, well, then, I mean, by that stage, then I was working, so I had kind of money coming in, and And the pub became the place that I spent most of my time in, and the off licence. And that's it. It was just, it became the norm. It just, there was no big rigmarole. It was just a very natural progression of your tolerance for alcohol rises, and you drink more, and then you need more. And it just, it was, like, if I'm being honest, it was pretty uneventful in that there was no major dramas, if you know what I mean. Maybe a few rows or that sort of stuff, but there was no, like, car crashes or any of that sort of stuff. I didn't have a car, but you know what I mean? There was those kind of moments. But
did you hold down your job still, and, you know, were you able to hold down your job?
Strangely enough, I held down the job because it was only down the road from me, so it was grand to roll out of bed.
Yeah.
And then what happened was the factory, because it was only a small stone factory, was closing. And your man said to me, listen, I still have a bit of year's work left. Do you have room to take machines home and whatever? So I took 2 sewing machines home and worked from home.
All right, okay.
Not realising that he wasn't paying rent. He wasn't paying me rent. I was just getting me wages as normal.
Jesus, right.
So there I was, sitting there with me sewing machines in the house, with me can of stag on the on the sewing machine.
Oh, my God, stag. Oh, when I hear a stag, that has terrible memories for me. Going back to me leaving cert. Oh, jeez. I could never got stag. No. Jesus. And those. Anyway, you don't see that anymore. Anyway, your stag is gone completely.
No.
But so you came home with the sewing machines, worked from home, which probably wasn't the ideal situation for you, because you would have been better to be trying to get up and going out.
Exactly, yeah.
And how long did the disco go on for?
That went on for a number. It went on a bit longer than the year that was anticipated, and then it eventually closed. And I'd say around when I was 21 or thereabouts, then there was no more work. And then I was just on the labour, you know. There was, you know, that was back in, you know, the late 80s kind of stuff. So things were pretty grim.
And who was in your life at this stage, Sandra? Like, had you met up with in a relationship, or was aunties looking after, looking out for you?
No, I had. I was in a relationship, all right, and that was all centred around alcohol.
All right.
So I suppose there was some element of stability there, if I'm being honest. You know, like, you know, he would have drank and he liked his drink, but he always went home for his dinner, where I just thought that was a waste of time, and, you know, I just couldn't get my head around that. But having said that, it did bring an element of stability. It did bring that kind of, oh, here, I don't want to row with him, so I better not, you know, do X, Y, and Z, or go here or go there. So, but I was very localised at that time. Like, I literally only went from the house to the pub around the corner.
And were you living in Dublin, down the country?
I was in Dublin, yeah.
Oh, you're in Dublin. All right, so you probably went to the Roller Disco. I went in Talbot Street.
I went to the one on Pleasant Street, over just off Camden Street.
Went there as well, yeah. Got a great taste. Yeah. But so at this stage, then you're 21, you're in a relationship. So where did it go from there then?
It didn't really go anywhere. Like, it ticked over for a while. Again, quite unsettling. Like, you'd have rows, and you'd only kind of, when, like, he got paid on one day, whatever, say Tuesday, and I got paid on a Wednesday. So Tuesday and Wednesday, we were the happiest people on the earth, and then the rest of the week, we hated each other. You know, there was that total kind of dynamic, you know, it was bonkers. And, you know, he was trying to pick up bits of work here, there, and everywhere. He did a bit of building work, and I got a bit of work doing different things and sewing factories and that sort of stuff. So there was always something to kind of keep you ticking over, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But there was no joy in my life, Debbie. Do you know what I mean? There was no happiness. There was no excited anticipation. There was no looking after myself. Like, my friends would all, like, they'd be buying makeup and clothes and whatever, and I was, you know, wearing clothes that people brought in black bags because they cleaned out their wardrobe.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, and you'd comfort yourself with, oh, should I just love a black bag party, you know?
Mm.
But ultimately it was because I wasn't spending money on clothes or any of those nice things that you would as a teenager or in your early 20s.
Yeah. And where were you living? Were you still in the family home, or had you...
Still in the family home at that point, yeah. Still in the family home, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So where did
and
it get...
And more kind of living, more living in the partner's house at the time than I was in my own, you know, like more kind of staying there.
Yes. So it wasn't really a stable kind of environment, no. really, for you. So how did it get to the stage where you kind of got to the point where you said, well, no, that's it, I can't do this anymore?
Yeah, so I'd gone out to, we'd had a row, myself and themselves had had a row, and I just said, I went out to my sisters and I said, look, I need to get my head together. I knew my head wasn't right, like I was, I don't know, there was nothing particularly happened, I just didn't feel right, you know. Yeah. So she was delighted that I was thinking, you know, I don't want to be drinking anymore, because God love her, she was out the door trying to get me to stop,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
And so I went out, did kind of managed well out there for a number of weeks and was very happy with life and that. Oh, this, you know, you can have a few bob in your pocket and not drink and that sort of stuff. And then one Sunday we had a holistic day, and there was a guy, a friend of hers, was doing a trainee reflexology type kind of stuff, and he was looking for people to be his models, if you like, or his clients, case studies.
Yeah.
So that was grand. We had this lovely day, and I hate reflexology, but I said, right, I'll let you do it anyway, and hey, anybody touching me feet? And of course, then we went to the pub afterwards, and I'll be totally honest with you, from the time I started drinking, I just wasn't right. I can just honestly say there was something not right, that you know, something had shifted, you know?
Yeah.
And then we went back to this friend's house, and of course, we started drinking and vodka and whiskey and all sorts of stuff. And when I woke up the next morning, I kid you not when I tell you, I seen my sister, her name is Rita, my sister who'd passed.
Yeah.
She was in the corner of the room looking at me saying, you can't go out like that. You have a hole in the top of your head.
Jesus.
Right. I was starting to kind of hallucinate.
Oh.
Frightened the living daylight out of myself. And I had to go back to where I lived, which was Cabra. I had to go back there and collect my payment. And I said to my nephew, who was 14 at the time, will you come with me? Because I was terrified going on the bus. I got that real panicky feeling about going on the bus.
Yeah.
And he came with me, and of course I got the payment, decided I'd have a drink to settle my nerves, went into the pub, brought him with me, and so I ended up spending the day in the pub.
Oh.
You know, then I sent him home thinking it was 10 o'clock at night, because he was in the way now, you know.
Yeah.
He was like, you've served your purpose almost.
Yeah.
I thought it was 10 o'clock, sent him home. Now lucky for me it was 6 o'clock in the evening, because I sent that child home on two buses from Cabra to Sword with just his bus fare.
Jesus. And how old was he?
And when I woke up, he was 14.
Oh, right.
And when I woke up the next morning, Debbie, I went, oh my, I screamed up to the heavens, and I swore very badly. I went, I can't second do this anymore. I knew it was over. Do you know that kind of way? I just knew it's over now.
Yeah.
And if I'd have done that, and I idolised this kid, well, he's not a kid anymore, but I idolised him, and I couldn't believe I had done that for drink.
Yeah, yeah. Yes.
That was my tipping moment.
And that was it. And had you had any children by then or anything, Sandra?
No.
No.
No children.
Right.
I still don't have children, no.
Right, so you said, well, this is it. You're going to have to look after yourself, because either that, you were going to go one way or the other. So who did you turn to? Like, you were never offered any counselling when all this happened, so maybe if you had been, it mightn't have got to that stage. But who did you turn to now? Your sister, obviously, your sisters died, but you had another sister alive, so she was great. She had to go cope through all this as well, with losing her, you know, her sister and father and the mother. Who did you turn to at this end? Was at this stage, was it still your sister?
Yeah, still my sister. So I went back to, she was living in Swords at the time. I went back to her with, you know, wanted to ask for help, and when she opened the door, she said to me, I hope you're here to pack your bags.
Oh,
and I just was like, but the pride in me, I went, I am, you know, real nonchalant, you know.
Yeah.
And she said, right, get your stuff, because she was like, you won't do that to my kid.
No.
You know,
and you can't totally blame her. Yeah, you can't blame
totally
her.
Totally understandable. Yeah. Absolutely. And she was it. She was the last person, if you like, that I could honestly say gave two hoot nannies about me.
Yeah.
And in that moment, I realised I don't even have her now. Do you know?
Yeah.
The loneliest feeling in the world, to know that the only person you could rely on, you've completely alienated.
Jeez.
You know?
Yeah.
So as I was packing my bags, I swear to God, divine intervention intervened here. I put my hand on my heart and I tell you that in all sincerity, Debbie. She came in and she said to me, "Do you want a cup of tea before you go?" And somehow out of my mouth came the words, "Yeah, please, that'd be lovely."
Mm.
And I sat down at the table and I said to her, "Mary, I know now what you're talking about. I know once I start, I can't stop."
Yeah.
And I just broke down. I just broke down and I said, "I need help." So she knew people who didn't drink or went to fellowship, and she rang somebody who came down, had a chat with me, and I got to a fellowship meeting that night. And that was on the 21st of March, 1995. And then life started. Actually, real life actually started then at that point.
Well, fair play, Chip. I mean, it was hard. It's hard to do. And what? How did you control how you felt? Because you had this crutch for so many years to fall back on. What? How did you? What made you strong? What made you kind of be your coping mechanisms when you hadn't got the alcohol?
I think it was really that very first meeting. I heard somebody talking about losing their third son to a drug overdose, and the man was talking about being so grateful that he wasn't drinking and being there for his wife. And I nearly gave myself whiplash, going, "What do you mean being there for your wife?" And to me, it was like, if anyone should be in the pub, it's you. And I just heard that. I just heard that. This is what this man does with his life now, is, you know, is all the things that people were for me over the years, he's now that for other people.
Yeah.
And that just seemed so attractive, like that. It just landed in me. It got in under my skin, and it became the most attractive thing I'd ever heard anybody saying, you know. And then being with people who've been down that road as well, who understand how your head goes and the kind of thinking that goes on, and you know, being able to talk with people who actually get you was a huge, massive help.
Yeah. Who knew what you were going through? You know, so, yeah, that's the when you, someone knows what you're going through. And talk, they say, it is good to talk, and it's good to talk to people who knew what you were going through. So the 21st of March was your turning point. So how have you been then, and what have you been doing with your life?
Oh, my God. God, well, probably ask me what I haven't done is probably quicker.
But
as I say, life happened. You know, I started to, I did a personal development course with a group within the first year or so. Again, that was great. Initially, I would have just kind of went to meetings and made kind of friends with people in fellowships, and that gives you a sense of bonding. And then there comes a time when you need to actually have a meaningful use of your time throughout the day. And I got a course, and that was great. That was really, really helpful. And then I got a job. And then that job was in the homeless sector. I worked for Focus Ireland back in the day. Mm. And I've been in that kind of work in one shape, form or another since then. You know, I've worked in homeless services, day services for people with drug problems, alcohol problems, young people services. I've been in that kind of, you know, social justice type kind of community development work really since then.
Yeah, brilliant. Giving back. You know, it's great to help people, because you've, as I said, you've gone there. You know what it's like. So if you see someone in the situation that you were in those years, going back 25 years, and I'm sure you would like to say, like, there is life out there and don't give up, and, you know, you can have a good life. So how did you come to the decision to do this Hoat to Dunleary? I know you said because it's coming up to 25 years. Have you ever done anything like this before?
I've done a couple of stretches of the Camino back when I turned 50. I had this realisation that I didn't really kind of think, now not that I discounted my dad in any way, but I would always kind of think, if my mother or my sister were alive, I wonder what kind of person I'd be with their influence, just curiosity. Yeah. But you know what, I realised when I was 50, I never actually thought about that from my dad. I never said, I wonder what kind of person I'd be if my dad was still alive.
Mm.
And I kind of felt, I suppose, a bit of guilt, or I kind of thought, oh God, that's, you know, I've been still keeping him out sort of stuff, you know, because it's not about blaming him, and it's not about saying, you know, he was evil or anything like that. I mean, I've long since come to terms with the man was unwell, and his actions were not the actions of a person who's making sane decisions. And as hard as it was, or as difficult as that was to understand, that's the reality. The man didn't make that conscious decision and go, oh, let's see who I can hurt today.
And in time, you kind of, I suppose, you learned to accept that. But I suppose the initial reaction was, why did you do it and how could you do that? But in time, he wasn't well, as you said.
Absolutely, absolutely. And getting sober really helped understand that, you know, this man was in his own torment and it wasn't somebody just being bad. You know, he was a very unwell man and that's, unfortunately, there were horrendous results, but, you know, it wasn't somebody going, let's see what we'll do for a bit of crack sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, that wasn't the intention. So understanding that really kind of helps the whole process. And then, but then, as I said, when I turned 50, I thought, God, I don't actually think about my dad in that way. So I decided I'd do a stretch of the Camino because it's the way of St. James and my dad's name is James. Mm. And I thought I'll do that. A friend of mine joined me and I kind of did. So you do 100 kilometres over, 105 kilometres or something over 5 days. So I've done a couple of those kind of retreat type kind of things, you know.
Yeah.
And then, as I say, the 25 kilometres from Hope to Dunleary, it just fit with the 25 years, and I thought, that's what I'm going to do.
And in the 25 years, Sandra, have you ever been tempted?
Do you know what? I wouldn't say tempted. Like, life, there's nothing attractive in a drink to me now. There's nothing that I go, oh, God, I wish I'd have a drink. Or if I see people out and about and, you know, I'm delighted that I can go out and have me Diet Coke and I'm grand.
And you're grand, yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah.
And that doesn't bother me in the slightest. I like the fact that I drive. I like the fact that I have that independence. If I don't like what's going on in the scene that I'm in, I get into my car and I go.
So you have that,
for me,
your way out.
Exactly. That freedom is more important to me than a drink. There's nothing attractive in it. But there has been times, Debbie, and I'm not going to lie, there's no Pollyanna story here where it's all happy clappy and wherever. Life has been very difficult in many ways and for periods of time that were longer than I would have wanted them to. And there has been times that I've often thought, do you know what, wouldn't it be just easier if you weren't here, right?
Yeah.
Now, I've never formulated a plan to take my own life, right? Mm. But I have gone to a point where it's like, this is just too hard. If it just was all over, that would suit me down to the ground right now.
Mm. And how did you get out of the when you felt those ways in that kind of headspace? How did you get out of that? By talking to people or going to meetings?
You know what? I'll be honest with you. I pray like nobody's, like I'm the only person left on the planet. It's like I don't want to be feeling that way, and I don't feel that way very often. It's just there was some major situations happening in my life over those years that were very, very, very difficult, and I got to a point where I thought I couldn't go on, but there's always that glimmer. There's always that bit of, I can do it for one more day.
Yeah.
You know, there's one more day left in me. And I have these ridiculous conversations with God where I go, right, I'm giving you one more day. I'm giving you one more day to prove that you're there and you'll help me, you know.
Yeah.
And somehow you're giving yourself that bit of a chance, aren't you? You're giving yourself that, I do want to live, but it's more a feeling than anything else. It's more that I don't know if I can hold any more of this.
Yeah.
It's just too much.
Yeah.
But you do, and we're here today, and I'm able to look back on that and go, thank God, like, you know, thank God, wherever that glimmer was.
Yeah, you're a strong lady, Sandra. You can see, you can hear it in you, you're a strong lady. Well, maybe that's good as well. So, are you doing this walk for yourself or for a charity or...?
I'm just doing it purely for myself.
For yourself,
I'm kind of going, how can I celebrate this? And I'm like, I'm going to go for a walk. That's what I do.
Yeah. So today you're happy in yourself. You're doing what you want to do. You're doing this walk. And fair play to you. 25 years is a long time. And Sandra, we could go on talking and talking. I'd love to hear more of your story. But today, are you happy in where you are and what you're doing?
Yeah, I'm in a good place, and you know, life is opening up new doors for me and new challenges for me, and I'm loving that. And I have a variety. I'm one of these people where I have a variety of things going on all at the same time, you know.
Yeah.
So I one of my jobs is I marry people for a living. I can legally marry people, so that's great. Yeah, yeah.
So you do a lot. You've a lot going on.
I do a lot.
Brilliant.
Yeah. And I do a bit of work with people in recovery as well. So that's I really like that because I really want to give back in that way as much as I possibly can.
Yeah.
So I do a bit of coaching with people who want something that's a bit more. What they can bring to the room sort of stuff.
Yeah,
they want a bit more drilled down coaching type kind of stuff on career and education and that kind of stuff. So I do that. So that really makes me feel, you know, yeah, I have skills and I can use them and use them well and people benefit. And I've always, when I think back on it, I've always kind of been like that I've always had several things going on at the same time. I like the variety.
Yeah. Well, fair play. You're a busy lady.
Yeah.
And
busy lady. Yeah.
Well done. And Sandra, maybe you'll come on again sometime and talk to us if there's anything else coming up that you'd like us to get out there.
Yeah.
So we're here for people in the community to tell their story. So Sandra, listen, thanks a million for talking to us and sharing your story with us today here on Lifeline.
You're very welcome, David. Thanks a million for having me.
Thanks, Sandra.